Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk, a show dedicated to exploring all aspects of creating a great dental office, where the only dumb question is the question that's not asked. Here's Jim and Han.
Good evening. Jim Jarvis here, along with my co-host, Han Tran. Han, how are you this evening?
I am doing marvelous, Jim. Just marvelous. How about yourself?
Doing well, and it's good to hear your voice. We apologize because last week was a failed attempt to do a show. Unfortunately, I did something really bad. I updated one of my systems, and you know, we've all been there, right? When they say update, you expect it that it's going to work, right? No, it didn't. The update worked, but it shut down half of something else and another thing of that. And this didn't work and that didn't work. And it's like Han and I are furiously trying to pull it together to be able to get it to function properly, but it just didn't happen. So we apologize for that. But today, episode number 92 of Straight Talk, and we're going to do one we haven't done for quite a while, and that's basically questions and answers. The questions have kind of piled up, and we thought it's important that we at least get some of these topics out there to be able to help everyone with some of the things that they're trying to get solved. And so we here tonight are going to spend the next hour kind of going over some things that have been hot on the subject matter. But before that, Han wanted to, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about some of the things that we've just gotten put in the airways.
So, good evening, everyone. And before we get into, our discussion, I'd just like to, again, remind you, this is a program that both Jim and I enjoy doing, but we do for the benefit of sharing information with our listener. We promise you, if you have a question and you call in, we won't identify who you are. We don't believe that any question, regardless how silly you might think it is, are dumb, because dumb question is the only one that you kept close to your chest, never asked. Okay, so we encourage that you either email your question in if you don't want to talk to us on the air. Or just call us and say, hey, I got a question, okay? And we'd be happy to address it, answer it. If we don't know, we will find out for you. We all would know, all right? Naturally, our phone number is 657-383-1442. That's to listen in or to call in. Anyway, the other part is that we have been published and featured in a couple of magazines, and we like to share that with you. If you're on our mailing list, you should already receive the first one. If you haven't, reach out to us, whether on our website or just reach out to me directly. My email address is htran@hjtdesign.com. I'll be happy to forward you the link to the magazine. One was written for general dentists. It was published last month in the Dental Town magazine. This month, it was published an upgraded version with more meat and potato for orthodontists. And so that was published this month in the Orthotown magazine. So if you are interested in reading them both or one, just reach out and we'll get you a link to listen to that. Okay? So that is my public service announcement, Jim. Ready to rock.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, let's talk about, obviously, we know we're still involved with COVID. We're still dealing with the some version or another. It's still out there. Some states, including Ohio, for example, are starting to see a resurgence of cases. We're moving inside. Winter or what bad weather is kicking in. It's getting colder, and so people are moving in indoors. And obviously, that is what they are saying could potentially cause another, I don't want to call it spike, but another wave of cases. Ohio's numbers, unfortunately, are going up. I'm sure that a lot of other states are kind of in the same kind of predicament, and we still have to be diligent. We still have to be careful. Han, you and I were talking, and I know there was some discussion on some of the other forum stuff about the idea of just being proactive on indoor air quality. And what does that really mean, and what should we be looking at?
You know, when you refer to the word, you often, if you read it in trade magazine, design magazine, stuff like that, the acronym IAQ, or also known as indoor air quality, and that in itself, it basically just tells you, what is the quality of the door, of the air indoor where you're at. We spend a fair amount of our waking hours inside a building, and the quality of the air within that building could drastically affect your health. You know, I mean, I think all of us have heard of Legionnaire disease. The things that, you know, depends on the kind of work you do. You could be subject to all kind of chemical particulates, impurities that are put into the air where you work. Naturally, OSHA, depends on how hazardous your work environment is. OSHA has a certain requirement to with PPE that you have to wear to protect yourself. You know, gloves, goggles, mask, whatever the requirement is based on your occupation. So in this case, because we're dealing with dentists, you have your own, most of you almost look like you're ready for the space program with all the PPE that you have to wear and things like that. So indoor air quality, and that's basically to protect the air you breathe in, okay, what the PPE that you wear, and also to at least minimize the potential of you being infected or you infecting the patient. Indoor air quality address basically what you breathe in. The level of the quality of air are dictated by the building code. So, wherever you are, whatever you do, whatever the building is, the code dictates the amount of or the number of air exchange within that building to meet a healthy condition. For a dentist office, it falls under the commercial office use, and that means that you are in the group with, barber, insurance, engineers, accountant, all that stuff. You can breathe in basically the same air. But there's a little snafu to that, is that in a dentist's office, you use a lot more chemical. You generate this nasty thing you call aerosol. So the indoor air quality within a dentist's office need to be, better. Higher level, higher number of exchange, better filtrations, and so on and so on. And if you, I assume that all of you, not just some of you, but all of you, have been keeping up to date with the CDC guidelines and all the new developments and regulations and mandates that you have to, to work and live within, so that way you can stay open. and you know, at least meet the minimum requirement and so on. And but we like to talk about, because some of the conversation is that some of the colleagues that say, well, I really don't want to, you know, it's not necessary for me to do this or do that because it seems like it's a waste of money. There is really no documentation, studies that said this or that. But we'd like to at least share some of our thought and let you chew it over. Okay.
Hey, Han, let me ask you a question. When you say that, you know, the code requires the certain level of indoor air quality, correct me if I'm wrong, but codes take, well, they're a combination of years and years and years of experience, calculations, on-the-ground kind of observations and determinations, and they're kind of like the government in the sense that it's like molasses. It takes forever for things to change and forever for things to move and flow, and their codes are not positioned and or up to date on fast changing environments like what we had to deal with COVID. Am I correct in saying that?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, code is just simply say, you know, it's like a comfortable level, acceptable level, but that acceptable level, that would be safer human occupancy. But there's so many things that can diminish that value so quickly. And we can go through an array of things that you introduce into a building that would diminish the safe, the so-called, it's still safe, but it makes it less desirable, if that makes sense. But it's like what Jim's saying is that codes don't often are not your, it's minimum. It's not the premium stuff. It's not beyond you're standing at the starting line. You haven't got off. So you got to do more. There's more to improving the indoor air quality than simply say the code say I can have 6 air exchange per hour, and that's why I'm going to stick to it, regardless.
Right. I mean, here, I'll give you an example. I mean, we all heard about Legionnaire's disease, okay? And that's a system causing disease. It finds its way into the HVAC system. It propagates and grows in there, and then it's spread through the building. That's been around for years. It's my understanding that there is really yet no criteria or requirement in the code that specifically deals on how to protect your occupancy from Legionnaire's disease. There's recommendations and there's some things that are in there that have to do with dealing with the specific coil and cleaning and those kind of things, but nothing in there. So I guess for the folks that are out there that are thinking, well, let's wait and see what the officials say have to be done, is that may never ever come. We may never ever get anything from the government that defines a requirement that says this is what you have to do as a bare minimum to fight COVID. So, like Han, I guess you said it the best way. We're kind of on our own in that regard, but mostly it's like you've got to do more than just the barest of bare minimum, because the barest of bare minimum doesn't cut it these days.
No, I mean, if you have a brand new building, okay, indoor air quality address a number of things. Okay, so in a dentist's office, there is chemical use. You use it for cleaning. You use it for, sanitizing. You know, between every patient, you clean up the surfaces and all that, and the aerosol, the cleaner. And it's not in micro aerosol format, but you're spraying it out and it gets in the air, okay? And of course, it gets into the air current and you breathe that stuff into at some level. You have aerosol in terms of, you know, when you work in the oral cavity, it gets out and, you know, again, it gets into the air. It's the same air that gets circulated, get mixed, and everybody gets to breathe it in. You have new carpeting, the off gas from the, you know, from the new material, the paint, the glue, and all that stuff. So there's a lot of stuff. Okay, so, you know, once you walk across the carpet, just the friction from your shoe will break the fiber. It gets kicked up in the air, and you get to breathe it. That's why when you look in the, when you look across the space where the sun ray come through and you can see all the stuff floating around, that's all the stuff that's in the air from the human activities. Your dander, your clothes, everything's in the air. So anything and everything you get thrown into that space affects the indoor air quality. And you have to take a little bit more proactive process to make sure that you have the cleanest air possible or cleanest air that you can afford to protect yourself, to protect your staff. And I think it depends on the motive, all right? I've been reading and debating and all that stuff with a number of your colleagues is that some, and Jim was the one that brought this up to me a couple months back, you know, a local dentist put up a badge, you know, a shield on his advertising document say, we guarantee COVID protection. And some of them put in a shield say, guarantee, sterile environment and things like that. Hey, if you want to market and try to tell your patient that you've done everything you can to protect them, I got to ask you, what are you doing to protect yourself and your staff? Your patient, you know, Mrs. Jones and the kids only come in maybe twice a year for 45 minutes to an hour. You and your staff live in that environment, you know, almost every day of the week throughout the year. So you are the almost permanent inhabitant of that office space. So wouldn't it make sense that the investment of that's necessary or whatever you feel is affordable to improve the indoor air quality for the permanent inhabitant so that they can remain healthy? If they're healthy, they're productive. They're healthy and productive, they're happy folks, all right? There's a number of things that can sideline you pretty easy. So indoor air quality don't have to be one of those things, okay? The conversation that I participated in early in the week and last week is the question was air purifier. Do I need one? Should I get one? That's a no-brainer. Okay, it's not something that will cure everything or anything for that matter. But if there's if the indoor air within your office a little bit stale, a little bit stagnant, or whatever it is, anything that you can reduce that is an improvement for you, your staff, and your patient will notice too. Okay, and it don't have to be something that are, you know, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a unit, but anything and everything that you can do to improve it is a plus. And whatever your pocketbook can afford or reasonably afford, on short term or long term, any improvement is a plus for, you know, for yourself and your staff. Think mm-hmm. of your long term health.
But I would add, Han, I would add the caveat is don't think that an indoor air purifier is going to protect you from COVID. It's like it's apples and oranges. Okay.
That is correct.
Yeah. An indoor air purifier does one thing. What's necessary to protect the people within a building from the COVID virus being spread is a totally different animal. So it's kind of like you have to be so careful. Sure, you don't want to put, you know, I guess I like to use the old terminology, lipstick on a pig. It's still a pig. Now,
but a pretty pig.
But it's a pretty pig. It's the same kind of difference. You know, just because your air smells a little bit better or has a different, less odors to it, does not mean it's clean, sterile air that will keep you from spreading the COVID virus. So you got to kind of couch that discussion with that kind of understanding. Don't expect one thing to do everything, because there is no one thing that'll do everything. I mean, we've obviously identified some systems and some combination of systems that will do a really, really, really good job of protecting the occupants, the patients, the staff, and of course you, the dentist, but it's not an air purifier.
Yeah, I mean, the indoor air quality is basically, the topic is to improve the air, you know, that you breathe within inside the building. Okay, so there's apparatus that would do that. You know, we certainly would be happy to assist you in, you know, in the research and all that. But when they deal with COVID, it's beyond indoor air quality discussions. Okay, because you now we're not talking about filtering the air. We're talking about filtering the air and sterilizing it, and rid of it, you know, rid it of pathogens that could be infectious. So it's a different level of discussion with different
criteria
strategy to address it. Jim?
Yeah, totally different criteria. And
yeah.
You know, obviously everybody's talking about the possible second wave, possible reoccurrence of reinfection and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, as it cools down and people move in to the interior, that might be coming down the pike. And nobody wants to be in a situation like they were when this thing first started. And everybody gets shut down, everything gets shut down, and there you are just taking it on the chin and dealing with that from a financial standpoint. That's a difficult thing. And when you talk about being proactive, you know, to be proactive enough to do something now to save you and your practice from ever having to do that again, you know, that takes a little bit of work, and it takes a little bit of a lot of knowledge and getting the right kind of systems in to make it so that you could weather the storm that's coming. Because if it's not COVID second wave, it's going to be something else. I don't think I'm wrong in saying that this kind of stuff is going to happen again and again. It's just a matter of what level and how bad it is. But, you know, obviously we had the swine flu, that we had the bird flu, then we had the N1H1, then we had SARS. And, you know, it just, the stuff happens, and we have to be able to be prepared to protect ourselves and our staff and our patients. So, I don't want to beat a dead horse in that regard, that you can't just sit there and wait and see what the officials down the road are going to say you have to do as a bare minimum, because by then it's going to be too late. We can't wait. We can't wait for them. On.
You know, Jim. Yeah. I mean, if you look at this as investing into or taking, you know, being proactive and investing into improving the, you know, the indoor environment within your office, whether it's COVID or any other, you know, sickness, you know, we like Jim say, down here in Florida, you know, I can go outside and sit in the sun and be outdoor. And unfortunately, up north where the weather is cold, Right now everybody's gathering a huddle inside, or starting to, and we are at the cusp of the flu season too. So you can't take it lightly. But I'm saying is that if you look at it as a cost, it will be a cost. How much it costs you when you're sick, or how much it costs when you're down, and not be able to come into work and things like that. So, there's plenty of data out there that have done a study on the expense of staff being not healthy to report for work, and the loss in production and what have you. But the anything that you can do to reduce the amount of pathogens, bacteria and germ and all that stuff within your space, within your work environment, will only help you. It only protect you and your staff, as well as your patients. So, we encourage you to look at more seriously than simply, I can solve this just by running over to Walmart and get myself a couple. If you call it air purifier, yeah, okay. But then basically you're buying an air filter with a little fan that's going to blow the air through a filter of some sort. That's just like a sugar pill, in our opinion, okay? So look at a system that I've created for your environment to address, the bigger, meaner type of infection, generating viruses and so on. Jim?
Yep, without a doubt. Well, let's jump into the next question / topic that was, we're actually kind of seeing this come up two or three different ways, but in general, the question or thought is, what's the best way to go about finding a space for my new dental practice? Now, that could be taken a whole lot of ways, and it could be that I'm looking to buy something, I'm looking to lease something, I'm looking to lease and or buy and lease to someone, kind of like a owner-tenant kind of arrangement, all those kind of stuff. But they all have kind of the same kind of things in general, don't they, Han?
Yeah, they do. I mean, whether you own it or lease it, when you look at space, there's a number of things that, that are on your checklist of must-have. Besides the general rule of thumb is how big of a space do I need, and things like that. So we can dive into this and kind of break up in pieces and give you our take. Jim?
Right. Well, the first thing that you would want to do is evaluate the space. Now, how do you go about doing that?
For me,
how would you go about doing it, Han?
Yeah, let me see. First of all, let me step back for a second. Jim and I spoke about this earlier, and there is a phrase that that you use in the process, whether you are leasing or you're buying. And it's the phrase is due diligence. That could be anything. If you're looking to acquire a new practice, part of that due diligence has to do with the number of active patients, the type of treatment you do, and things like that. And what we're talking about, the due diligence, because we deal with buildings, so the due diligence that we often talk about and do with site and buildings. And often buildings are rather low on the list, if at all, as part of the due diligence. Okay, we find that if you say, okay, how big of a space do I need? Where do I need it? And all that good stuff. Naturally, the more exposure, the more visibility that your potential space have. The more people are going to see it, the likelihood they're going to come, and all that improve your opportunity to be more successful. sooner, bigger, faster, and what have you. So in terms of, location, you might want to be, that general rule of thumb, be where the people is, grocery store, gas station, schools, and so on, if all possible. You want to have eyeballs looking at you, okay? Look at you often. Where I'm going to sound sexist here, where the decision maker goes to, because most of the activities, taking care of the kids, grocery shopping, all that stuff, is still being done mainly by the women of the home, okay? The mother, sometimes it's the women of a couple of our children, she still makes all the appointments. So anyway, you want her to see where you're located. But in terms of size, that's pretty easy. It depends who you talk to. Do you have a five treatment room practice? The rule of thumb is we range anywhere between 300 to 500 square feet per treatment room. It depends on who you talk to. Okay, and you take the number of square footage allocated to each treatment room, multiply by the number of treatment rooms, and in general, you will have the size of practice that you need. We'd say make sure it's rectangle in size or in shape, so it's easier to work with, and you get the best yield out of the space. So all of that is rather, rather easy. But anyway, help me out a little bit, Jim. Is there anything else?
But as you say, the due diligence is much, much, much more complicated than, and unfortunately, like you said, it's just not these two or three or four little things. There are so many little items that need to be addressed, that we address when we look at and evaluate a potential property, whether it's for purchase or whether it's for lease, that you need to know. You need this information before you sign on the dotted line, before you close on that property, before you have fallen in love with it. We all do this. I mean, we make decisions with the feeling side of our head. We make those decisions because it feels right, don't we? It's not because, no, that's the most
logical.
Yes,
we do.
Yeah. Spock makes decisions because of logic. The normal person makes decisions based on feeling. And
we're not Spocks.
Yeah,
right?
And we're not Spocks.
Some
of us might be, but most of us are not. And so we make decisions based on those feelings. Now, the thing you have to resist is making those decisions without having the information. And that information is crucial. It will save you potentially lots of sorrow, lots of extra cost that you didn't need to incur, and maybe save you from yourself of putting yourself and the practice in the wrong place. Now, the things that we're talking about are things like the ability of that space. Let's say you're looking at an existing retail space. The ability to be able to turn that into a dental practice. Okay, there are things like codes. There are things like existing conditions. There are things like the condition of the particular space itself, and what level is it, and what you have to do to it. What kind of money do you have to put into this thing to turn it into a dental practice of the level that you want to be? So you've got to have that information to be able to compare apples to apples, oranges to oranges, space A to space B. Now, we've seen it, and for the clients that have come to us early enough, we help with that review and due diligence process so that we'll be able to evaluate. We'll look at one space and say, okay, to be able to turn this into a dental practice of the level that you want, you have to do this, 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 and this. And that kind of has a potential cost of X. Space B, you have to do these kind of things because it's maybe it's has a different interior configuration. You have to tear out more, or you have to do some other upgrades or other conditions. And so it's going to cost you X times 10. Well, if the leases on both those spaces were exactly the same, what's the answer to the question? Which one should you pick? You pick the one that costs you X from a business standpoint, the logical side, not the feeling side. The feeling side, well, I like space B because it's prettier, or it has whatever. But it's not the best financial decision or for your particular business because of maybe it costs more to be able to renovate. So that's just one small condition, and we look at every aspect of that space. One space may have a brand new HVAC system, and the other space has one that's 15 years old. Well, then you say, well, that's the landlord's responsibility. Yeah, it is, but it becomes your problem the minute you sign the lease, and now you have to fight with the landlord to get them to replace the HVAC system on that unit that just went down the day after you took over the space. Because we know, Han and I know, that most HVAC systems have a very limited lifespan. Some of them won't last more than 10 years. Some of them, when they get from the 10 to 15 years, they're on their last legs, if one would say. So unless they're perfectly well-maintained and everything is good to go, you might be looking at having to fight with your landlord to get them to replace the HVAC system. So what would you do? I know what Han and I would do if we were in that case. In the lease agreement negotiation, we would mandate that the HVAC system had to be replaced before we took over the space, or it's a no deal. That's how you protect yourself. We're here to help you, to protect you. And that I guess that's what we're trying to accomplish in this discussion is, how do you protect yourself from those things that could come back and just, you know, really cost you quite a lot of money, huh?
Yeah, I think the discussion could go pretty much anywhere, whichever scenario are more fitting for you. So let's simply look at leasing. For most dentists, especially when they're in the early phase of their career, they lease the space, okay? Right. And part of your due diligence may include a commercial building what do you call them, inspector, okay? But they inspect the existing conditions and the system and what have you. I don't want to say smarter or dumber, but if you are more proactive in knowing what to expect and stuff like that, I would encourage you to include that piece of inspection in your due diligence. So that way you know what you're getting yourself into. A building is not a building is not a building. They're all not created equal. So if you don't know, like Jim say, you have great exposure, all right, great visibility, plenty of parking, and all that other stuff, but you didn't know that the electrical service is subpar. You didn't know that the water service is not enough, not large enough in size for your practice. You didn't know that the mechanical equipment is on its 16 years. If you don't know all that, once you sign the lease, if it's not in the lease as a replacement or an upgrade, or it's in your tenant improvement dollars and stuff like that, it will become your problem to solve. It will become your money to resolve. Okay?
Right. And it could be things accessibility. It could be things like periodic flooding. I mean, we're dealing with a client that literally is dealing with that issue. The space that they're in floods. She has had water in her operatory. It's a leased space. You think, Really? That really happens? Yeah, that happens.
Yep. Yep. Go ahead, Jim.
No, I say, you know, that kind of stuff happens. How do you know about that? Well, it only happens during a certain time of the year because of the spring rains. So if you didn't know about that, or at least had an evaluation to be able to determine what some of the criteria or issues are, you would never know until actually it happens. And then it becomes a battle with your landlord.
Yeah, so it's good to know, so that way you know what you're getting yourself into. It could be also the knowledge about the space, the history of the space and things like that is a tool that you can use to as a negotiation chip, okay?
Right.
But where do we come in? There's engineers that we work with that could do all of those assessment with your building system. They know what needs to be done and so on. From an architectural standpoint, I think this is where this is not promoting for us. I mean, it's just, this is things that we strongly believe that will benefit you. It will be horrible if you fall in love with a space, sign a 10 years with 2 renewal, and then hand it over to, and then you go, I need to get a designer or architect to help me lay this space out, and discover that it's not big enough for you, or it's such an awkward shape that it only yield less than desire. The size, in terms of square footage, may be perfect in theory, but the actual configuration may not work out. So
yeah. You can only get 4 off.
Yeah,
Yeah.
So we encourage you to, the people that the people on the team, such as broker, realtor, even contractor may tell you, yeah, we can do anything, or of course you can, and so on. That's not good enough until you actually see a layout. And so your design professional, your architect, and so on can actually put the ink down on the paper and say, yes, it will work for you. Yes, all of the code requirements are met. And they can identify all kind of stuff. Let's say you walk in into a 2,500 square foot space, and you're going to put in 3, 5, or 6, or 7 treatment room, and you didn't realize that the floor elevation within the building changed 2 times. That means that either you rip out the slab, or you put in internal ramps. Okay, those little details can be a nightmare if nobody tells you. To point out to you that to solve that, it costs money. Or who's going to pay for it? Or you should look at someplace else, because by the time that you fix all this, it's still not going to be at a level where you need it to have, to have a dental practice in. Sometimes it can't be fixed. Okay, so your design professional can be invaluable in this process. Hopefully, before you sign the lease.
Yeah,
the
definitely.
Worst time
I guess
you can
the most
call them to help
part,
you.
Yeah, the most important part of it is before you sign the lease or before you sign that paper. Get that review by somebody who knows what they're doing. Well, we got a little bit of time left. Let's jump into this one more subject that I think is kind of related but also semi interesting. And Han and I have been seeing a lot of this lately, and it's the aspect of a dental practice that's coexisting either within the same space or within the same building with other providers, be it a medical provider, be it a non-medical provider. And, what are the advantages and disadvantages? What are some of the things that we've been seeing? And I just think that's an interesting subject. I think there's a lot of potential advantages, and there's some really bad disadvantages. So let's talk about what some of the advantages are, Han, in that scenario.
Yeah, I want to clarify this. I think Jim is referring to a space that with several service provider coexist within the SAM space.
Yeah,
okay. We're not talking about a service provider that are offering their special services in adjacent space. Okay. I mean, the discussion goes often go on the side of, no, you shouldn't do this or shouldn't do that because of this or that reason. And when Jim and I were talking about it prior to the show is that, you know, the term one-stop shop is the first thing I think of, is that why is it that specialists cannot coexist in the same environment, same office, share similar staff, similar equipment, and so on and so on. Why is it that if you are a general dentist, you have to be in your own practice, and a pediatric dentist have to be in their own practice, and orthodontist and all the other specialty? Because if you look in any community, there are clinics, and those clinics, you can go in there and pretty much have everything you needed. They may not have an orthodontist in it every day, but just like any private offices or privately owned practices, you schedule. So if there is a specialist that need to come in on a certain day, the schedule for that, that particular patient to come in on that day, so that specialist can take care of them on those days. It's a funny discussion because a lot of people shy away from it, but if you look at the dynamic of, of clinics, hospitals, I mean, all the specialists come together in one place and they share a common resource, and they seem to do pretty well. So now we had a couple clients recently. They came and say, hey, I'm a general dentist. I have a daughter that is a medical doctor, or in this case there was two, is a beautician, and one is into the only word I can think of is estheticians, where you do Botox and what have you, and you want to have a practice that all of this services under the same roof. How can it be done?
Absolutely.
We think so.
Very much
yeah.
so.
Okay. It has to do with it requires a little bit more out of the box thinking, a little bit more creativity. Your designer have to understand how the traffic, how the clientele or patient are mixed or should be separate. They have to understand the traffic flow so that they don't interfere with each other. They have to understand the industry that each one of those specialists or each one of those business entities need and produce and all that stuff, so that they can, so that the design can create a very harmonious environment for all of them to work in and thrive in. Because if you don't have a design member on your team that don't understand the dynamic and the logistics of how all those businesses work, and that where they share common space, it could be disastrous, but it can be very functional and advantageous to each and every one of those individuals. I mean, think about the practice that the client that came to us and talked about is that you can, it's a medical facility or a medical campus, and in this case, it's part of that practice. Hair. They cut hair and they do like a beautician salon, and so they have the dentist have to do a little bit of thawing to get that approved and okay. But if if the environment or the park where all this business is in, all this busy people are in, they all have hair that need to be cut or dye, whatever. Those things, those services can be provided within reach, within reasonable time and all that. It's a convenient for them. So if you provide a quality service at a convenient location with convenient timing and all that stuff, why wouldn't it be a plus? Okay.
And the advantages, as you say, are huge. Think of all the administrative stuff that you can share. All that overhead, you've got your reception area, you've got your billing, you've got your, if it's a medical provider, you've got your insurance kind of stuff, you've got your potential accounting stuff. I mean, that can all be broken up into three or four different pieces and parts, depending on how you're going to break this up. So all that administrative overhead that you have to pay, if you had two providers on top of the one you have, you basically break it into three. I mean, that's a big reduction. We all know that staff is a very large cost in your overall business plan. And so to be able to reduce that drastically like that seems like a good way to go. If you can get the right kind of group dynamics. Now, obviously, there are some bad group dynamics. You don't want to share a space with some other provider that, gives you and your practice a bad image or a bad overall impression. That's not what you're looking for. You have to kind of think outside the box. But, is it practical to think that you could be a general dentist and have an association with a dermatologist? I think so. You could have a chiropractor, a dermatologist, for that matter, it could be a ophthalmologist, or it could be any of the dental specialties. Add all those together. Now, we've even seen where it was a dentist and a lawyer. It works. So, thinking out, like Han, you said it best, thinking outside the box, you can combine all that together. It works.
Yeah, we have, we work on a practice that was over in Australia, and it happens to be a medical clinic with a dental clinic. If you're a team member, I myself have had experience with design and work on hospital. So when I look at the function of a medical practice and a dental practice, yes, it's medical associated, but they function differently. So you have to have the right people on your team that know how each pieces and part work independently and how they can work together. So that you can really maximize the real estate resource as well as the human resource to make everything work accordingly. Okay,
and
there is a lot
creative,
of other issues.
Right, with some creative design, you can give each one of these practices, I'm going to call them that, each one of the practices themselves, their own identity. So it's not like you walk in and say it's all the same space and it only has one identity. For example, Han, I was telling Han a little bit about the one internal medicine doctor I just went to this week, moved into a new space, all put together by one of the local hospitals here. And there's 10 different entities within this space, and they're all sharing all the administratives. So you got an internal medicine, you got a couple others, you got OBGYN, just you name it, it's all in there. And unfortunately, in that kind of scenario, each entity did not have its own identity. Well, with some creative design, you can create identity in the two or three spaces or practices that are all combined together. That can be done and probably would be advisable so that you don't have that kind of blend together where everybody loses the individual identity. I don't think we would recommend that. I think we would do the latter. Huh?
Yeah, we have like for instance, our very own Dr. Hunsinger, in his practice, he is a general dentist. He have, the office was designed for a general dentist practice, but within his practice, you have pediatric dentists and orthodontists. As he built the practice up with the patient base and stuff like that, where the need for orthodontist space had outgrown the patient or what the space available, he went off and built a standalone, or should I say a orthodontist office, so they could move that entity out of the practice, and that particular setup was done for approximately 10 years. Okay, so you can. It depends here on your business plan. You plan it out, and when you're ready for the next phase, you can separate them, and now you have more clinical space for the general practice, and then dedicated space for the orthodontist. So you just have to be creative in the way you run the practice or grow the practice, and so those things can work. There is a lot more than simply planning it in terms of design, but the dynamic of how those businesses interact from a legal standpoint, who own it, and what happened when one sell or retire and so on. Trying to find the like mind that embrace the same business model and stuff like that. It requires a bit more work, but that one stop shop, we say, can actually work well.
Creatively thinking outside the box could potentially lend yourself into a much better business financial situation and allow you to how's it say work harder and smarter at the same time? But
work smarter, preferably, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully this has been, we've blown another whole hour, and hopefully this has been informative, and you had an opportunity to hear a little bit from the answers to some of the questions that were raised. Feel free to send them in. Han and I are here to answer. We'll do everything we can to try to get an answer for them. Obviously, as Han said, check out the articles that have been published. If you have any questions or information that you'd like to hear from us, get a hold of us on our website or through the email, through the phone number. It's all on the web. We just look forward to spending another hour with you next week. We're quickly approaching show 100. And that's going to be hopefully a kind of interesting milestone for Han and I. So with that, Han, thank everybody, but I'll leave you with the last words.
Fantastic. Been fun, Jim. Jim say we burn, but I think we share an hour of fun and fun facts and all that stuff with you. I hope you learn a few things. And that you can apply that to your own practice or put it to good use. Appreciate you spending the hour with us. Everybody stay safe and healthy, and we'll talk to you again soon. Until then, have a good night.
You've been listening to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk with Jim and Han. To contact us and find out more info about upcoming shows, please log on to our website at www.hjtdesign.com. Until next time.